Hi, everybody. I'm Kathy Heekin, and I'm recovering one day at a time in the Worldwide Al-Anon Family Groups. Hello. It's sure nice to be here. I would like to thank the committee for the invitation to speak, and in particular to Deborah, who not only made the initial call, but has kept up with me all the way until I arrived. I came out a little earlier because I could, and stayed with my dear friend Mary, who I've known for over 50 years. And so it's just been a wonderful experience so far. To tell you the truth, I thought that this was a little Easter Al-Anon convention. I really did. I thought, oh, what a nice little quiet way to spend the Easter. That'll be great. And then Mary actually, I think, or Deborah, forwarded me the program, and I thought, wow, they have a lot of AA participation. What a generous Al-Anon group. Jesus, Mary, and Joseph. But I was talking to my daughter, who happens to have almost 10 years in AA. I talked to her yesterday morning. And she said, now, where are you, Mom, this weekend? And I said, well, I'm in San Diego. And she said, for an Al-Anon convention? And I said, no, actually, it's this huge AA convention. And she said, you're a sideshow, Mama. Whatever. Anyway, I'm glad to be here, and I've just been enjoying myself to no end. So thank you for the opportunity, and thank you for the opportunity for allowing me to share with you what some of the miracles in my life have been thus far. I have a son. Well, I've got a couple of some. Well, one of my sons says to me when I start, well, he'll ask me a question, and I start to, you know, I'm trying to be of service, so I start to answer, and he goes, fast forward, fast forward, fast forward. Yeah, he's cute. So, you know, I don't like to get stuck too far in the, you know, we say in Al-Anon, it's a good idea to look at the past without staring at it. And actually, I came out of a wonderful family. I mean, I have a mother and father who adored one another. I grew up knowing that I could trust happiness. I was very secure. I'm third out of six kids. We're close. I don't know. I mean, it was just a middle kid, middle class, middle America. There wasn't anything too terribly different about the way that I grew up, except in my family, it was really important to be funny. If any one of us six kids got in trouble at school and we came home to explain ourselves, if what we had done was funny, all was forgiven, and those nuns just didn't have a sense of humor. I mean, it wasn't us. It was them. And the other piece is my dad was a newscaster. And so growing up, he had erratic hours. I mean, he would be out the door at 4 in the morning, and when I was really little, he was on the radio. And those were in the days when they had to find the news. I mean, they would, you know, get the police reports, go out and find the news, write it themselves, and then deliver it. So as a young kid, well, really my entire life at home, my father, when he would come home, whenever that might be, we would be constantly regaled with these stories of people who had done all sorts of outrageous things. And I have no memory of my father ever judging them as being sick or evil or cruel. They were always presented as being kind of interesting and creative, I guess. There was this one man who had he murdered his wife, but then he chopped her into pieces and sent her to Cleveland in a trunk. And I don't know, maybe I was the only one of my brothers and sisters, but I thought there was something really neat about that. I mean, that. So maybe I'm fooling myself, but that's why I think, even though I was a kid who always followed the rules, I always followed the rules unless I thought I could get away with it, I was always attracted to those people who could chop up their spouses and send them to trunks in Cleveland. I don't know what it was, you know. I mean, I was thinking yesterday, Corey and I found a little mission where we went for, you know, to do the little Stations of the Cross. And I was thinking, even when I was a kid, those boys that used to eat meat on Friday, oh, man, I mean, they had my heart. I thought that was the bravest thing that you could possibly do when I was younger. And so, you know, even though, again, I'm the kind of kid who always felt, I mean, I have over 16 years of an education by really good nuns. I mean, that's the only way. They were really good women, almost to a woman. There were a couple who were bizarre, but we knew they were. And so with that, there was very, you know, there was a lot of damage control in that. But we were taught, Mary will back me up on this, we were always taught the importance of love and service. We were always, I mean, it was just drilled into us, the importance of putting yourself last and putting others first. It was always important to us, the whole concept of suffering, because that's what really would shape your character. But it had to be silent suffering, or it didn't count. So, you know, all those messages, and yet even at home, I would come home with these stories, you know, and tell my mother, and she would always say, take that with a grain of salt. Take that with a grain of salt. I never knew as a kid how to take things as a grain of salt. I took everything to heart. And I believed that I had a real responsibility, a real mission to help you. It didn't really matter how I was feeling. What was important was how you were feeling. That was what that's what I got. Now, I have five brothers and sisters, and I don't know. They don't seem to have gotten the same message that I did, although we all went to the same schools and were raised in the same home. But what happened to me is I became addicted to approval. I tried so hard to lead a life that was above reproach. And so one day when I was in college, I had been dating one of the nicest guys you'd ever want to meet in your life. He was from Indianapolis. He was this really kind Hoosier. And he was going to school in Cincinnati, kind, patient, loving, loyal. But it was summer, and he was back in Indianapolis, and this woman that I kind of knew but didn't know really, really well, she called me and she said, Kathy, my brother is coming to town. He's a Marine. He's in flight school. I've fixed him up with everybody I know. I've run out of ideas. Would you be willing to go out with him over Labor Day? That's just the kind of job I'd take. I mean, really. The Vietnam War is raging. Here's the guy's a Marine. Of course I'm going to say yes. What else would I say? So we went out, and I'll tell you, I liked him immediately. And I liked him because I sensed that he could have cared less what you thought of him. And I found that to be attractive because I'm someone that always cares what you think of me. I always want to make sure that I'm saying the right thing, that I'm being the right person. And here's this guy. He walked up to the door to pick me up, and he had this silver cup monogrammed. It was filled to the brim with bourbon. And that was our first date. But I thought that was kind of neat, you know? I mean, I'm used to these college boys who are drinking that god-awful 3-2 beer out of plastic cups, spilling it all over. And here's this Marine. And so this began a long-distance relationship as he moved from Meridian, Mississippi, to Beeville, Texas, to Pensacola, Florida, and finally to Cherry Point Marine Corps Air Station. In the meantime, I've graduated from college, and I move up to Chicago to teach school, and we are in this long-distance relationship, and the only time we're really together is when he can get to Cincinnati, and I can get to Cincinnati as well. I can remember one date that we had. He asked me if I had ever flown before, and I had never been in a plane. And he said, well, let's go flying. Now, for somebody like me, I mean, born and raised in the city, love the feel of concrete under my feet, the thought of flying is really exciting. And so we went down to Lunkin Airport, which is a small little airport in Cincinnati, and he rented one of these little Piper Cubs. And we go over the Ohio River, and he's flying, and oh my God, I am just so sure that I am in love. And he said to me, "Do you know what a stall is?" And I'm like, "Oh, I don't know what the hell he's talking about, you know?" So he does this stall over the river, and the next thing I know, you know, the two of us are nose, you know, heading for the Ohio, and he pulls it up, and, you know, I came home from that date, and I said to his sister, the one that had fixed us up, "You know, I think I'm in love." And she said, "That's not love, that's fear." And the only other story I'll tell is that my father-in-law-to-be raised quarter horses. And so he lived out on this family compound, really, where they had all these quarter horses and the big main house and all these little houses where different family members lived. And we would go out there once in a while and ride. One weekend, he invited me to go with him to Indiana, where friends of his had horses, and we were all going to go riding. Well, you can't imagine for a kid like me, for a woman like me, I suppose, at that time, what something like that was. What? I mean, we were going to get these two horses and put them in a trailer and drive over to Indiana and meet other people with horses. I mean, I think I'm in a movie. So we get over to Indiana and, you know, he's saddling our horses, and somebody that was there from the Indianapolis, he was a banker. He had chosen a horse to ride that was really way beyond his capacity. And he got himself stuck in a corral or in a little stall. And the horse was between him and the exit. And the horse sensed his fear, and the horse started to make noises, whatever they make, and he started to shove the guy up against the barn wall. And so the call goes out, "Where's Rick? Get Rick." Well, I'm with Rick. And so I follow Rick into that barn, and I watch him climb over that gate and reach up around that horse's neck, grab that horse's ear, and bite that horse's ear as hard as you can. Because that will paralyze a horse. It would paralyze me. Anyway. And then he takes the saddle, throws it on top of the horse, leads the horse out of the stall, and all is well. And I think at age 21, that's the guy I want to spend the rest of my life with, you know? And so that's really, you know, how it all kind of came down. One Christmas, we were having dinner with his family. He's one of seven. And he told his family that he had an announcement to make. I was fairly sure he had gotten a promotion within the Marine Corps. And what he announced was is that we were going to get married. I didn't know that. But this is me. I'm thinking very quickly, and I'm thinking, well, probably we're going to get married anyway, but if I say something, how will that look? And how things look kept me in a very bad place for a long, long time. For a long time. And so I made the adjustment. And that's what somebody like me continued to do. I just continued to make the adjustments. We went to my parents to announce it to them. They were absolutely horror-stricken, but they never said a word. They never said a word. They just began daily prayers all the way, really. And I didn't find that out until years and years later. So we get married in January, move to Havelock, North Carolina. I'm pregnant by February, and in March he gets his orders to go to Vietnam. I was so relieved he was leaving, and I knew that that was not the reaction of a loving bride, because I'm with all these Marine Corps wives who are just beside themselves, even though they knew it was coming. You know, they're all wringing their hands, and what are we going to do? Maybe we should all stay here, and we can bond together. Not me. I wanted to go home. I just thought that if I could go home for a year, I could figure it out. I could just figure it out. And I've heard it in other speakers that I've heard so far this weekend. You know, that hope that maybe I'll be able to come up with the right words, with the right actions, I should be able to fix this. Because I come from a home where I was taught that really, trust in God and all will be well. All will be well. It will work out. My mother used to say to us when we were little, it'll be better before Christmas. You'll be okay. And I come out of a home where we were not. I think Stephanie said it last night. You know, those of us who are my age, we were raised by parents who came out of a depression, who came out of World War II. It wasn't that my parents were uncaring. I knew that I was loved. But nobody ever asked me during my childhood, how do you feel? They didn't really care how I felt. I mean, it was just, no matter how you feel, you just do what you have to do. You make your bed, you lie in it. And that's true for my brothers and sisters as well. I mean, I've got 5 brothers and sisters who have known great tragedy in their lives. My oldest sister has 6 children. 3 of them have been diagnosed with cystic fibrosis. I have a brother who, his young wife, died of breast cancer and left him with 3 small children to raise. And my youngest brother, between his junior and senior year in college, he had a landscaping company to pay for his tuition, and he was involved in a job he never should have been involved in, trying to top trees, and a limb fell on him and caught him, and just he just lost his entire left side is gone. I mean, he lost his arm, his leg, and yet the 6 of us go to New York City for a weekend in December and have for years just the brothers and sisters, and you would never imagine that anything had gone wrong in anybody's lives because we were never taught or allowed to complain. And, you know, that really, well, it has done 2 things for me. It kept me away from Al-Anon for a long time. But it also, once I found you, has given me a great intolerance for whining. I mean, Jesus, Mary, and Joseph. I mean, there is a lot of stuff going on in the world today. And, whew, I consider myself, no matter what has happened, to be very, very grateful. To be very, very grateful. For all the blessings of my life, no matter what. My brother without the arm and the leg. Well, you know, tell you, all my brothers and sisters are pretty darn funny. But my brother without the arm and the leg, I'm a swimmer. And he started to take up swimming after he lost his arm and leg. Now, you'd think he'd swim in a circle. I mean, I got this visual. But what's funny is that he doesn't. And he lives up in Rhode Island, and he participates in this Save the Bay. It's a 2-mile swim to save Narragansett Bay. And I used to take my kids up to Cape Cod for the summers and still try to. And he would call and say, I'm going to come up for the weekend while you're up there. Would you spot me while I swim in practicing for this 2-mile Save the Bay campaign? So I'm like, sure, John, come on up. My kids used to hate it because we'd all have to go to the beach with my brother. We'd all have to go down to the edge of the water. He'd unscrew his arm and hand it to one kid, He'd unscrew his leg and hand it to 2 others, and they'd all have to drag his parts back to our, to the towel. And all these wonderfully proper Bostonians, they're all on the beach reading their Boston Globe, pretending like they're not looking. But, it's just such a sight. And then on his one leg, he'd turn with his back to the ocean and jump backwards and, he'd get into the surf, and the next thing you know, he would just start swimming. And anyway, I only go into that to tell you that's the kind of background that I come from. So when I'm faced within 10 days with a situation that I at some level know I am never going to be able to fix, my only recourse at that time was just to pretend like it really wasn't happening. And so I took those instincts, which were, get out of here, just leave, wait till he's flying somewhere, get a check, make your way to New Bern, North Carolina, and run home. All those instincts were immediately stopped cold by how will it look and my need to be right. And those two obstacles will stop me and continue to stop me unless I'm willing to surrender to a program that you offer me, which will absolutely lead to a transformation of me, which will absolutely. I am convinced in my own experience with Al-Anon that this 12-step program is one of letting go. It has just been for me letting go of one thing after another, letting go of those I love, letting go of the way that I think things should be, just letting go of it all. And I have had to really let go of the past. Because when I try to go back and think about how I could have done things differently, it's just a stranglehold on my spiritual life, because it's me just trying to be perfect. And I've never met, I used to believe in a God of success, and you have introduced me really to a God of failure, to a God who really meets me not in the midst of success, but who meets me face to face in the failures that I've known. And so Rick got his orders to go to Vietnam. I come back to Cincinnati, make a date with the priest that married us immediately, and as I'm walking out of my parents' home to meet with this guy, my mother says to me as she's closing the front door, "I hope you're not going to tell him anything personal, because that's just the way that it was for us." But of course I didn't tell him everything personal, because I'm ashamed. I'm ashamed to let anybody know what I'm living with. So I change the story, and I leave out large parts, because what will you think of me? Not to protect him, because honestly, I don't really care what you think about him. What I care about is what would you think of me? What kind of woman lives with this kind of situation? What kind of woman and wife cannot fix these things? And so I spent a year hoping that things would be different when he returned. And of course, when he came home, nothing really had changed much at all. He got back from Vietnam. Eventually, he got out of the service, decided to take the GI Bill and go to dental school. And right before we left for Ohio State Dental School, he was beaten up badly in a bar in northern Kentucky. And those 3 years in dental school, there was no drinking. Now, I thought it was because I had been patient, because I had been long-suffering, because I hadn't nagged him. And I thought, those nuns were really right. If you just can hang in there long enough and be patient, everything will work out. But what happened, of course, is after he got his degree in dentistry and we came back to Cincinnati, where he began to set up a practice, his behavior began to change. And for me, when his behavior began to change, I kept up. All these years, I thought I was adjusting to marriage, and what I was really doing was try to adjust to alcoholism. And there's no healthy way to do it. There was just no healthy way to do it without some sort spiritual program of recovery, not that I have found. And so I would wake up and try to always stay one step ahead of him, constantly trying to make the rough road smooth, always hoping that when he woke up, he would be in a good mood. But I think for me, what was most damaging is, and for my children too, if I may speak for them, it's never knowing what was going to happen next. Because what was going on was my husband was now writing himself prescriptions for narcotics. And I couldn't really, I knew something was really off, but I couldn't find the alcohol. And when it comes to that sort of addiction, I'm just no good. I'm not really any good at discovering any kind of addiction. When I later got into teaching high school, I remember, and I should have known better because I had a house full of teenagers myself, but I remember the one of the teachers around the corner who taught special ed came to me early in the morning, and she said, "Hey, Kathy, will you come into my classroom and smell a couple of my kids? I think they've been smoking pot before class." And I said, "Karen, I am no help at all in this area. Go find somebody in the English department. I have no idea what pot's going to smell like." So very quickly, what happens is this. We are now living on this family compound because, you know, he just started a practice. We've got no money. The GI Bill has been shot. And we're living in this, I mean, if you'd come to see us, oh my gosh, you would have thought it would, I mean, what a beautiful setting. You just pull in this long driveway that just wound around all these, you know, those little split rail fences, grazing quarter horses till you got up to the main house, which overlooked the Ohio River, the hills of Kentucky. We're staying rent-free in this little house. It's called the Summer House, where they used to put up jams and jellies in the summer, and next to it's a pool, and there's tennis courts and barns. I mean, it's just gorgeous. But inside, it's nothing but chaos and insanity. Because I spent years holding my breath. I spent years gathering evidence and building a case. I spent years never knowing what was going to happen next, what was going to come in the door. And I tried so hard to keep that truth and that reality of the family disease of alcoholism away from my kids. And so there was a book that somebody published in the 70s or 80s. It was called "I'm Dancing as Fast as I Can." I have no idea what it was about. But I remember seeing the title and thinking, I am dancing as fast as I can. And I have to be ever vigilant and ever on guard because it's up to me to keep all these balls in the air. And I've just got to be sharp. It is, as Stephanie pointed out last night, it is exhausting work. It is exhausting work. I weighed at this time about 108 pounds. I had my hair in a ponytail so I didn't have to care for it, and I'm smoking about 2 packs of cigarettes a day. And every time I go home to see my parents, my mother will say, "Just wait long enough until I fix you a milkshake." I mean, all she wanted to do was try to put some meat on my bones, but I'm a wreck. I'm an anxious, nervous wreck, but I think that I'm fine. Because what alcoholism did to me was it took any hope or any idea or any plan I might have for me, and it put it on the back burner where I then focused all my attention on somebody else. And so it is a robber. It's a thief of my life journey because I no longer am paying attention to my journey. I'm no longer paying attention to the presence of God in my life the way I understand God to be. I'm focused on somebody else's journey, and I'm trying to micromanage that. And that, for me, is the essence of the tragedy of the family disease of alcoholism. I got so sidetracked in my life, and that was nobody's fault. As my sponsor says, you lay that at the feet of alcoholism. Lay that at the feet of alcoholism. It wasn't long before my husband was arrested by the local, the Regional Enforcement Narcotics Unit, and was arrested and thrown out of dentistry, and what followed then were years of unemployment. he did find some things to do. You know, sometimes when I tell the story, and I gloss over this, but had you met my husband, you would have been, I mean, he was just absolutely, he was very frightening. But Mary will attest to that. I mean, everybody was scared of him, but for me, that was part of his charm. But but he was so talented. Everything he did well. When he was, when he flew those, he was an RF-4 pilot. During a time when most pilots, you know, were assigned helicopters, not that there's anything wrong with that. I have a son who's a helicopter pilot today. But it was just that they would only, so few during those days could, would get to fly the jets. He did it beautifully. When he was a dentist, he graduated with honors, and that's with a house full of kids. Everything that he did well. So that when he was thrown out of dentistry, what he turned to, even though it was kind of crazy, he did well. He established a vegetable garden. It was out of this world. He decided to raise bees. They were wonderful. I would watch him go down to his bee place, whatever you call those things, you know, with his hat and his netting and his gloves, and I would think, oh my God, I'm living in a bee movie. What the hell? He's a beekeeper now. I mean, it was just crazy stuff, but he was so good at it. And so he decided once he was thrown out of dentistry that he would become a fox hunter. He was a fur trader. And as I would say to people, becoming a fur trapper, it used to be a lucrative profession back in the 1780s. In the 1980s, it doesn't bring in a lot of cash. But my job then became repackaging it, you know? That's why even as a small kid, my father always told me he thought I had a career in public relations. I'm very good at repackaging things. And so people would say to me, because it never hit the papers, why did he leave dentistry after all that training, 3 years of dentistry? That was when they did those accelerated three-year programs. Why is he no longer a dentist? And I would say, he found that to be far too confining for someone like him. He's bigger than dentistry. You know, he's a Renaissance man. He's into the bees and the gardening and, he's into the furs and blah, 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 blah. And, I know nobody bought it, but at least I thought they did. Because what was important was that looking good. What was important was that you thought I had it all under control and that you thought I had the kind of life that I always only wanted for myself. But inside, I am absolutely hollowed out. I'm absolutely hollowed out. I am on the verge of craziness. Well, I am crazy. What can I say? I'm just frantic. And we say in our literature, our thinking becomes confused, our perceptions distorted, we become unreasonable without knowing it. I was unreasonable, and I knew it, but I didn't know how to fix it. And that's the state of affairs. That was the state of affairs for me. And now we've got neighbors. I don't know how it is in San Diego, but in Cincinnati, what used to be, acres of this beautiful horse farm were being encroached by suburbs. And people who don't understand us are now moving into the neighborhood. And so now the phone's ringing and the suburban wives, I used to call them the Stepford wives. The Stepford wives are calling and they want to know, have I seen boots? Well, I know my husband now has the infrared glasses so he can hunt at night. And I'm quite sure that Boots is long gone. I mean, I don't know where Boots is, but I got a feeling Boots isn't in any of our fields hunting quail and pheasant anymore. So I would go to Rick and I'd say, Rick, are you shooting cats? And he would say, not the skinny ones. I'd say, what? He said, no, not the skinny ones. Because if the skinny ones are hunting for quail and pheasant, they're hunting to survive. But if they're fat, they're just hunting for sport, and they've got to go. And so, I know. And so, but for me, who's got to take the calls, I have to adjust my thinking. So I have to start thinking in terms of, well, that makes sense. If they're killing for sport, I guess they do have to die. And you see, that's what happens. I would never hurt a cat. I love cats. But the only way to live with that kind of thinking is to adopt it yourself. It was like the birds. He loved birds. I mean, in all of his spare time, he had suet, you know, attached to the trunk of the beautiful oak right outside of our bedroom window, and the woodpecker and a hummingbird feeders, and the beautiful, what are those things that I love so much, the gold thing, goldfinches. But if a blue jay came into the neighborhood, he used to sleep with a gun next to the bed with the window open because, God forbid, a blue jay come anywhere near. Blue jays are the felons of the bird world. They've got to go. He would reach around and grab that rifle without even, or whatever, that shotgun, without even picking his head up off the pillow, and kaboom. And I would go running down the steps, that responsible mother, and warn my children to take all their friends and play on the other side of the house because Dad was hunting that day. And so you had to be sharp. You had to stay on your toes in order to keep up with all of it. And so what happened was a sister on the family compound joined Alcoholics Anonymous. And then another sister joined Alcoholics Anonymous. And then a third sister joined Alcoholics Anonymous. And then in very short order, I have four sister-in-laws who are all members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they still are members of Alcoholics Anonymous today, and they are active members. So, because I've got the little house by the pool, they, of course, come to swim a lot, and they're always carrying with them the book. I used to call it their blue book, just to annoy them, basically. But and, you know, they would talk about recovery, and I could see that they were changing, and their lives were changing, and I could see that they had discovered a new peace and a new freedom. And for me, you know, that 11th tradition of attraction rather than promotion is so very important, because it was because of their recovery. It was because their recovery became so attractive that I began to listen when they came for me and talked about how alcoholism was a family disease and it had been in their family for years. Now, that was all very well and good for them, but I was tired. And I had been looking for help, you know, months after we had been married. I had been to so many places. I had been to social workers. I had been to psychics. I had been all over the place. I had been to a woman that continued to, a psychologist that told me it was important that I speak in I statements. So I would go home and say, I hate you. That's my I statement. And so, but you know what? The piece that got me, the hook that caught me was this, a family disease. Because I had always operated on my 8-year plan. Rick was 4 years older than I, and generally women outlive men by 4 years. So I always thought at the end of my life, I'd have this little 8-year plan. 8 years of relative peace and quiet. 8 years where I didn't have to worry constantly about what was coming in the door. 8 years where one more time I could begin to let go of my breath and begin to breathe again. But if it's a family disease, what am I to do? I am pregnant now with child number 7, and I'm beginning to think that my 8-year plan is in jeopardy. And so I did the only thing that I knew to do, which was to go to an Al-Anon meeting and just do some investigating. Just do some investigating. I don't have to join. I hate group things. Oh, my gosh. I thought, oh, no. This is going to be like some cult thing where everybody talks back to you and echoes. And, you know, it's a funny thing because not so many years ago, I was up in Washington, D.C. visiting a friend of mine who had just gone through a terrible divorce, just bitter and horrible. And she and I were in some state park up there in Washington, D.C., Sugarloaf Mountain or something like that. And we had been walking a trail, and we had come to a spot, you know, at the top of a rock where there are benches, and you can just sit and talk. So she's talking to me about the bitterness of it all and the anger, and I'm giving back to her what I know, you know, about the importance of letting go and the importance of, you know, believing that there's something better out there, blah, 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 blah. All of a sudden, we hear from down below us this voice that screams, "Is somebody up there a friend of Bill W.'s?" And I think, holy mother of God, I am in a cult. So I go to this beginner's meeting, and I said to this woman, you know, I don't know that my husband's an alcoholic. And she said, well, let me ask you this. Has his drinking ever been a problem in your life? And I said to her, every time my husband drinks, it's a problem because somebody gets hurt. And she said, well, you're in the right place because this is a program for you. And that's what I heard the night that I got to my very first Al-Anon meeting, April the 5th, 1982. And I have never forgotten that those important words. Al-Anon is a program for me. It doesn't matter what anybody else in my life is doing. I come to Al-Anon so that I can continue to recover from the profound effects of the family disease of alcoholism. It's for me, and it's about me. And that's why we say in my group that the importance is we don't talk about the alcoholics in our lives. We keep the focus on us because it's about my recovery. And that's what she said. She said, it's a disease that you didn't cause, you can't cure, and you can't control. I never thought I caused it. Always thought I should be able to cure it or control it. Always thought that if I loved well enough, he would be better. And when that didn't happen, I began not so much to turn against him as I began to turn against myself. Nothing my husband ever said to me was as cruel as the things that I used to say to myself. Why can't you figure this out? What's wrong with you? You thought you were so smart. You turned into be such a coward. You are such a... all that talk, all those tapes that would constantly play in my head against me. How I must have broken the heart of a loving and compassionate God by the words that I spoke against myself. But now this woman's telling me it's not your job. I felt better at the very first Al-Anon meeting I ever attended. That beginner's meeting, I was given immediate relief because it's the first time anybody had ever suggested that he was not my job. I think at some level I always knew it, but I took to Al-Anon like duck to a water. I loved it. I loved that let go and let God. I thought that was brilliant. I would go home and I didn't do a damn thing. We ran out of diapers. Of course, they were cloth in those days. I just didn't really care. What's for dinner? Don't know. Where are the kids? Don't know. Thought they were somewhere around. I went from one extreme to another until you finally brought me back to where it was appropriate. And when I couldn't get to meetings, I got tapes. You know those little tapes that we used to have? I still have some of them. I didn't care whose tape I listened to. It was an AA tape, an Al-Anon tape, an Alateen tape. You just all had what I wanted. And that was recovery. And that was recovery. What else did you used to? Oh, you used to say, you know, you don't have to fight with him. You can simply say, well, you could be right. You know, you could be right about that. So I would go home and what would normally start in to this struggle and this fight and my constantly, you know, trying to, thinking that I was the keeper of truth and justice in the relationship. You know, he would say something that normally I would find to be absolutely outrageous, and I just would learn to say, well, you could be right about that. And then what happened is that I had all this time on my hands to do something better, to do something positive, learning to let it go. I have this little nun friend that doesn't say let go and let God. She just goes like this. And that's how Al-Anon teaches us to live. Just let it go. I mean, just, you know, having been here since Thursday, I can hear it among all the committee. That wonderful stance of just believing that God is in charge. And you know what? It'll work out. I have the same sponsor that I've had from the very beginning. And she always says, Kathy, God will sort it out. Let God sort it out. And I trust that. And I believe that. And I know it. And that's different from intellectually saying it and believing it up here, is knowing it with your heart, because I've seen it work. I've seen it work. And so, you know, it was here that you taught me that failure is the beginning of wisdom. And that's where we all start. And that's where I started with you. And you are the ones that taught me, you know, the importance of the group. My, you know, for me, I had to rely on the wisdom of my Al-Anon groups. They are the ones that helped me to shepherd my thoughts. They are the ones that showed me what it meant to live with a life of choice. They are the ones that showed me to trust that this was a program that really was all about miracles, that God would do for me what I could never do for myself. And I believed you. And I didn't believe you so much because of what you said. I believed you because of how you lived. I was just saying to a friend in the program, you know, you can go to, if you want to lose weight, you can go to Weight Watchers 7 days a week. But unless you begin to change habits, you're never going to lose weight. And that's the way I feel about Al-Anon. I can go to 7 meetings a week and I can sponsor rooms full of women. But unless I'm beginning and willing to change my attitudes and change my behavior, there is no recovery for me. I will still be stuck in that quicksand of the disease. So I'm beginning to show up and things are beginning to change in our home. And my kids said to me once, Mom, what's different? Is it the meetings that you're going to? I said, I think so. And my older kids then started to go to Alateen. Now, they didn't stick with it, some of them, very long, but that's where they learned this was not their fault. This was not their fault. It wasn't what any one of us was doing or not doing. And that's still, for me, an important, message to remember. I had a woman whose son was thrown into jail for theft to feed his heroin addiction, and she called me a few months ago, and she said, I don't know, should I go visit him in jail? Should I not go visit in jail? I don't really want to go to jail. I don't know what I should do. Boo, boo, boo. Can you help me? And I said to her, you know, you can go visit him in jail or you cannot go visit him in jail. But his decision, you know, to either recover or not recover doesn't really have a thing to do with the number of visits. I mean, do what you want to do, but don't think, you know, don't attach it to his recovery. Those are the things that I learned early on, and those are the sort of things that you continue to remind me about. My recovery has to be about me. It cannot be engineered by my expectation that you'll be different, because expectations in our program are the seeds of resentment, and they are dangerous. You are the ones that taught me that detachment was neither kind nor unkind. It just meant that we are now unwilling to get caught up in somebody else's consequences. But I've also learned that nothing would ever change for me until I got a sponsor and until I began to do that fourth step. Because we talk in Al-Anon about the four M's: managing, mothering, manipulation, and martyrdom. And I had to look at how those four M's were manifested in my life. I had to look at my own arsenal of weapons of destruction, which will always kill and poison love and respect in any family. And I had to become responsible for my attitudes and my actions. And that led me to taking my first fourth step, where I had to honestly take a look at me and then to share that with my sponsor and begin to see my part in it. My part in it. If you had told me before I reached Al-Anon that I had anything to do with this mess, I would have denied it completely, because I was so good at looking like I was okay. And that's why so many of us get missed. because we're not falling down drunk. We're not waking up in gutters. We continue to look like we are fine, but we will die of this disease just as surely as if we contracted cirrhosis. We'll just die in ways that oftentimes go undetected. And often we'll die alone because we'll go out being bitter, angry people, blaming our lives on somebody else. And that's not the way I want to leave. That's not the way I want to leave. So it wasn't long, you know, made amends to my husband. Things began to change. But unfortunately, my husband had tried AA, scared the living daylights out of him. And he had this hobby that he built. It just always seems that Marines, I don't know, this is probably a wild generalization, but they just strike me as being dangerous types to begin with. And so even when he was done with the flying jets, you know, he still enjoyed flying. So he had this experimental aircraft he used to fly. It was no more than like a throttle, and it had a little motor in the back with blades on top, and it was like flying a lawn chair. And I used to just resent his flying that because I had all these kids and I was always stuck at home, you know, with these fox furs hanging outside the kitchen window. But you said to me, does he find some peace when he flies? And I said, he loves it. And then you asked the question, then why would you want to take that away from him? If that's where he finds peace, why would you want to take that away from him? He's not a bad guy. He's just a sick guy. So my whole attitude about it changed. And one Memorial Day weekend, as he was walking out the door, I said to him, Rick, have a beautiful day. It's a beautiful day. Have a wonderful time. And those were the last words I ever spoke to him. Because 2 hours later, as I was coming up the driveway with a station wagon full of kids, I had the highway patrol behind me, and they asked me to pull over and to tell me that my husband had crashed and died. And I just want to say this, you know, I have noticed as I've been listening to speakers, there seems to be a lot of dying. And this morning when I was listening to Kurt, even though I know that, you know, life involves the mystery of suffering and death, and I can't explain it. I don't know. I just know that I never have to walk through it alone. But when I was listening to Kurt and he was mentioning his 5-year-old child, I thought, don't let that kid go. Please don't tell me that kid's gonna die. And he didn't. So, but anyway, but what happened in that moment, and I don't always tell this piece of the story, but what happened in that moment is that Rick's mother was coming up the driveway, and she was older and not well. And when the police spoke to her, she came towards me with her little cane, and she wrapped her arms around me, and she said, "Thank God he's out of his pain." And I have never forgotten those words of hers. Thank God he's out of his pain. I don't know why he couldn't have embraced Alcoholics Anonymous like now 5 of his siblings. But he didn't. But he is today in the arms of a loving and compassionate and merciful God. And that's enough for me. That's enough for me. And even though Al-Anon is for me and for my own recovery, what happened next was I had to walk into that house with 7 children under the age of 14. And for the next 20 years, my Al-Anon program was about me as mother. What kind of mother did I want to be to those kids? Because some of them were already, of course, into trouble. They were already being, you know, calls from school, this and that, stealing no-dos. Who the hell would steal no-do? I don't know. I don't get that. But, you know, just... And so Al-Anon, for the next 20 years, taught me how to parent those children. And it's a very narrow road between parenting and not enabling. And sometimes I didn't always get it right, I'll be honest with you. I took those kids to a grief counselor right after Rick's death, and though they were just misbehaving, I mean, they were just awful. He had given them crayons to play with, and they broke all the crayons and threw them at each other. And so finally the guy said, let's put them in the waiting room, which we did. And I sat there in front of him, and I said, Gene, I don't think I can raise these kids alone by myself. And he said, oh, you can't. You're understaffed. And what a wonderful thing for somebody to say to somebody like me. You can't. You're understaffed. And so I've always had to rely on a power greater than myself because I couldn't do it alone. I could only do the best that I could do one day at a time. And that, you know, that's what Al-Anon just fed me, spoon-fed me, constantly. You can you can't be your children's higher power. If you are, they'll never find a higher power of their own. But the most powerful amends you can give to your kids, make to your kids, is to give them one healthy parent. And so even though my mother would say, Kathy, why do you still go to Al-Anon? Rick is dead. I would say, because I'm not. I'm not. And I need to rely on this program because it is a spiritual way of being. Because I do ask myself, what kind of woman do I believe I'm called to be and invited to be? And I heard it last night. It's not even about who do I want to be. Who am I invited to be by this God that invites me into this intimate relationship? That's why it's really important for me to carve out quality time of my day for prayer and meditation so I can pay attention, so that I can be aware of the presence of God in my life. And I'll tell you, it was really because of those seven kids who got into a lot of trouble. They kept me on my knees, and for them I will always be very, very grateful. It is not easy to see your children appear before you in a court of law in handcuffs and shackles, and I've had to go through that with several of my kids. There's no inoculation for that kind of pain, but I've never had to walk through it alone. The fear of not knowing where a child is, it can be numbing, but you have taught me that God is in charge, and I've come to believe that. And yet, there have been moments, you know, when I was listening to Deb speak last night, I have a son who's in Germany right now on his way to Afghanistan for his third deployment, and he's a Chinook helicopter pilot. His last tour of duty in Iraq, I was sitting at a computer opening my mail, and the news flashed, and it said, Chinook helicopter shut down, entire crew lost west of Baghdad. And I knew that my son flew Chinooks, I knew he flew west of Baghdad, and I knew he flew at that time of day at night when they're less of a target. And so I immediately went to my email, went to him, and just wrote in the subject line, let me know you're okay, send. And then I walked outside. And I walked outside with my hair on fire, and I looked up to the sky and I said to God, I know that there have been hundreds of thousands of mothers who have buried these children as a result of these wars. I hope this is not mine, but I know if it is, you will not abandon me. And then I went to a meeting. And when I got home that night, I ran right to my computer, opened up my email. And when I saw that letter in my inbox, without even reading it, I just put my head down and wept. And when I opened it, he said, I'm okay. That was my replacement crew. But what I knew was there were five mothers that night who were not getting an email in their inbox. This is what Al-Anon leads me into. This, not only this community of people in recovery, but into a greater world where we all are trying to do the best that we can do at any given time. And because I'm committed to recovery does not mean that life will skip me. I know that. I know that. I have kids whose drinking is a concern for me. They know it's a concern. I don't nag them. I just have said to one, just not so long ago, "Your drinking is a concern." He says, "My drinking isn't a problem. It's a hobby." I'm like, and my response is, "You could be right. What do I know? What do I know?" And so, you know, truly, I'm going to end it here pretty quickly. But I do find it very important, and always have, to do those daily inventories. Boy, you know, I just start writing down all the ways that I was the woman I want to be, and I believe am challenged and invited to be. And then there's that column, you know, that seventh grade girl who I really don't want to be. But I know, because you've taught me, I can't aspire. I can't aspire for more than being human. I just can't. But I also know, because of the practice that you have given me of going over, of inventorying my days, I can see so clearly the fingerprints of God all over my life. It is so clear to me because of those spiritual practices you've introduced me to through this 12-step program. But I would never want to leave here allowing you to think that I have been the perfect mother. God knows I have not. I've just done what I could do. My kids were in trouble a lot. They were in trouble so much that one of the referees at juvenile court in Hamilton County, she was adopting a baby from China, and when her co-workers threw a shower for her, they invited me. So I got a lot of calls to come to school. And after Rick was killed, I was invited to begin teaching high school, for which really I wasn't qualified. I had an expired elementary school certificate, but this, you know, it was a Catholic school, and I only mentioned that because at that time they said, "We don't care. Just come, we'll give you all your insurance, we'll figure all that stuff out later. You can go to school at night in summers, don't worry about it. Just come, we just want to get you some insurance." And that's how it worked for me. And so I started teaching this wonderful high school. It was just a great place, and all my kids could go to school there free. The guidance counselor told me that because my husband had served in Vietnam and had died, all my children were eligible for free state tuition, and so all the kids were allowed to go to, had a free ride to any school in the state of Ohio. So they went to Miami University, Ohio State University, UC. I mean, it was just, as you had said, all turned out to be well. Everything fell into place. And spending days with those teenagers, God love those crazy teenagers, they taught me how to be a parent to other teenagers. They were wonderful. Two of my sons were thrown out of that high school twice, not once, twice. They'd come to get me, you know, somebody, the principal, and I'd say to the kids, "We're going to get a sub, I'll be back," and my students would say, "He got thrown out of school again, didn't he, Mrs. Heakin?" And he did. But I would come back to that school and have to remind myself, I never got thrown out of high school. I had a great time in high school and in college. It wasn't me. But, you know, it's that separation, because sometimes the disease of alcoholism just looks like a big plate full of spaghetti, and it's hard to know where one strand ends and another begins. Al-Anon helps me with that. The youngest one, I was called to his school in the middle of an ice storm. The principal called very apologetically. She said to me, "I know you've got to teach this morning, but could you just come down and meet with all of his teachers? There's a problem." So I said, "All right." I go down there. All the teachers are around the table. There's my little guy sitting there. He's 7 years old. And the first teacher starts, and she says, "Whenever anybody in the classroom sneezes, he falls out of his desk." I think that's wonderful. I love that. I don't say that, though. Then the second one, you know, he's always tapping his pencil, and he knows that annoys me. I'm thinking, I have a program for you. But I don't say that. And so they go around, you know, and it's one thing after another. And as a teacher, I don't belittle any of it. It's annoying when you got 35 to 40 kids in a classroom and somebody starts that. I know that. But I'm watching this little guy, and he's just sinking further and further into his chair. So when the whole session is over and we've all got to get back to our classrooms, I say to him, you come with me, Nick. I want to talk to you before you go back into school. So I drag him out to our car. I put him in the front seat with me, and I look at him, and I say, you are a wonderful kid. You are a great kid, Nick. And I don't know where God is in all of this, but I know, I mean God, I don't know where Rick is in all of this, but I know one thing, wherever your dad is, he's looking down here today, and he's proud of you, because you're great. But you got to knock off this stupid stuff, because it's annoying. So, you go back into that classroom, Nick, and you knock him dead. And this little kid looks up at me with tears in his eyes, and he says, I'm Daniel. And that's the way I parented. I mean, whatever, get out of here. I got to get to school, you know? So I'm not telling their story. I got a kid in Al-Anon. I got a kid that's got almost 10 years in AA. I've had two sons in AA, no longer in AA, blah, blah, whatever. All I know is this. I know what I need to do. I have this program. I need this program. I love this program. I'm sticking with this program. I've retired from full-time teaching, but now I'm into something else part-time that allows me a lot of time to really enjoy things. 98, that nice little guy that I was dating in college came back into my life. We had always kind of kept in touch because we had always been such good friends. He had sent me a letter when he got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous in Indianapolis in 1990. And actually, a guy he got sober with is living up in Escondido. And I said to him, if you show up at that luncheon instead of playing golf with that buddy you got sober with who you haven't seen in 7 years, I'm going to throw you right off the table. So Mary came in his stead, and he's right where he needs to be. But he contacted me in 98. He'd never been married, never had any kids. That's what I call a double winner. And he said to me, he said, hey, I don't know if you're married or what, but you know what? I've moved back to Indianapolis from California. It'd be great if we could get together now and then. I look at that note, and I think, I love being single. I mean, I love being single. I could be the poster child for single women. I love it. I love painting my living room a different color every Friday night when I come home from school. I've had it every color of the rainbow. My kids call it the clown house. I love to paint walls. I love having microwave popcorn for dinner with juju fruit sprinkled in for flavor. I love that. I like going to parties by myself. I'm bored. I'm leaving. Drive myself home. I love being single. Women say, yes, but don't you want somebody to send you flowers? Oh, get a life. Go to Kroger's. You can get three bunches of flowers for 10 lousy bucks, any kind you want. Come on. This is the life. And now I get this letter, and I think, I cannot discount God. I cannot discount what God's plan may be. This guy keeps turning up in my life like a bad penny. My youngest child's name is Daniel. We named him after this guy. I mean, he's great. So, I don't know. I think, well, we'll just try. We'll just try. So, 98, we start to date. 2000, he moves and gets a little apartment in Cincinnati. And in 2005, my youngest graduates from college. I retire from full-time teaching. This is all in the month of May. And Mr. Wonderful and I get married. And I'm going to tell you, we walked up that aisle. Mary was there. He's got his Indianapolis grade school friends. I got my Cincinnati grade school friends. He's got his high school friends. I got my high school friends. We got our mutual college friends. He's got his all AA people from Indianapolis. I got all my AA Al-Anon friends from Cincinnati. All of our kids, all of my kids are in the, our kids are in the wedding. He doesn't like to hear that, but all our kids are in the wedding. My mother, who will be 95 next month, is my maid of honor. She's as sharp as a tack. And as we headed down the aisle at St. Francis de Sales Church, the whole church erupts in this huge standing ovation. Not for us. Not for us. For a God. For a God who can bring such joy out of a lot of suffering, who can bring great peace out of a lot of chaos, and who can bring such a beautiful miracle to the lives of so many. that's what that whole thing was about, and that's what it continues to be about for me as I continue on this journey of recovery. So that when my daughter graduated, I only had one that won a full scholarship. When she graduated, I mean, to a school outside of the state school, graduated from St. Louis University, the woman that was giving the commencement commencement address was a little bit late, and when she finally got there, she said, "I apologize, but my little boy wanted to recite the Lord's Prayer to me before he left. He's just learned it." And she said, he stood before me, and he said, "Our Father, who art in heaven, how'd you know my name?" And when I heard her say that, I thought, you know, if anybody asked me for, if you just had to sift it all down to one gift for me, I would say to you that the gift of this program for me is that relationship again for me with that God who knows my name. And for that, I'm very, very grateful. Thank you.